You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and just yesterday, you've tuned into an episode of Curiosity Invited. Great pleasure for me. I had the opportunity to speak with an old friend, an extremely talented musical composer, Michael Abels. He's been on Curiosity Invited a few times in the past, and actually twice in the past, and about to be the third. And he's an extraordinarily talented human being, a recipient with Rhiannon Giddens of the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for Music, is an Emmy and Grammy nominated composer. Many people know him for his work as musical composer for Jordan Peele's films, Get Out and Us and Nope. Also Bad Education, Allen versus Pharaoh, Chevalier. I mean, his work is popping up all over the place, and will be popping up this coming week, actually. That's June 2024, where it's the launch of the Disney Star Wars series named Acolyte, and Michael is the composer, musical composer for that. I always have a wonderful time with Michael. We sometimes get to where we plan to get, but mostly we meander because he's an extremely adept wanderer in the world of both music and so many other things. So I hope you'll enjoy it. I certainly did. Now, Michael Abels. So hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the great pleasure, for the third time, speaking with composer Michael Abels, that other fellow on the screen with a big smile. And anyway, thank you, Michael, for doing this and being here. And I know you're really busy, and I will be... I was about to say I'll be lean with your time. No, I won't. because we meander, and that's one of the great things I love about it. But since last time you were here, we spoke just after you were awarded. You and Rhiannon were awarded the Pulitzer, and that's pretty spectacular. And has your life been busy and busy and busier and fuller since then? I know you're working on projects, and we'll definitely get to one of them in particular. but are you working on all sorts of projects now as well, always?
Fortunately, I'm really lucky in that I have an opportunity to work in different genres and different venues, and yeah. I enjoy anything where there's an opportunity to write music. I think I'm down for that, especially if it's something unusual or surprising that I'm not known for in some way. So yeah. So I have a lot of good opportunity to do that, and I just try to pick the things that excite me and then balance my time.
Yeah, I really did. One of the things that was on my mind has been on my mind is that, and we'll get to that, but there is that question about like bleed through, right? I mean, if you're working on four different projects at the same time and they are different enough, they're under the umbrella of music, usually. They're under the umbrella of music, but they're different enough to be in both different genres or different universes, different sets of expectations and conditions, do they bleed through? Or are you able to keep them discreet and compartmentalized in a way where they don't interpenetrate?
So they don't bleed.
Yes, they don't bleed.
You know what? And like, see, so no one's ever asked me that, and I
figured that.
Do you know this strange thing is that they mostly don't bleed, I don't think.
And which is interesting.
That surprises me. Like when you ask it that way, I think the reason they don't is because when you said compartmentalize, I often think of a creative experience as you're being in a room where this project or this idea exists. And I do this when it's part of how my memory works. Like if you have an idea, this came all the way from where you're driving on the freeway and suddenly you have an idea of a melody and you know it's good enough that you want to preserve it, but you're stuck in traffic and you are going somewhere and you have, you know, that, and that's usually when good ideas happen, when it's not convenient for you to capture them. So as an artist, the first thing you have to realize is that there's a point at which not capturing these ideas will cost you money.
not all artists have that problem, I think.
Well, no, it's true, but it's not just that it'll cost you money, it'll actually cost you the quality of your art. Like, you know, a good idea, you know, some people maybe are just hit with them all the time, but I consider mine precious and I need to, you know, listen. So
yeah.
I have a disagreement with the muses that I'll listen when they tell me. And so you have to pull over or do whatever it is to capture an idea. But I find when I'm hit with an orchestral idea, for example, I'll hear like everything at once. Mm-hmm. And it sounds amazing in my head, but there's no way you could possibly capture all the detail of what that is. And so what I noticed was that if I describe it in any particular way to myself, like I'll have a conversation with myself on my phone, I'm recording and I'm like, it goes like this, da 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 da, you know, it goes da 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 da, and then, you know, and this is the strings are doing that and the brass have chords and then it shifts in this particular way. And I talk to myself in a way that only I would understand. And I just do it. I sound like I'm crazy, kind of, because I'm both singing and talking to myself in a way that I would understand and no one else would. But if I do that, as much as it seems like it's hopeless, what it does is when I listen to the recording, it brings back the moment where the idea happened.
Really?
And I think it's similar to like how many of us have said, oh, I need to get my book and it's in the kitchen. And you walk to the kitchen and you look around the kitchen and you're like, what am I doing
here? What the hell am I doing in the kitchen?
Right. And then invariably, the only way to know why you're in the kitchen is to go back to where you had the thought.
Yes.
You go back to the other room and the thought comes back.
Right.
My belief is that this is how memory works about everything, not just why you're in the kitchen, but it's with creative ideas. So there's a room in your mind where the creative idea is occurring and you need to remember how to go back to that room because it's still there, but you just have to remember where it was that you had the idea that you had to get your book.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
So I make a report that basically is me telling myself, this is where the idea is in your mind. This is where it is. So when you hear this, recording, remember where the idea is in your mind and go back, go where that idea is and start, you know, and listen to it now that you can. So this is a very big idea, but it relates to what you asked me.
Yes, right.
Exactly. Remember.
Yeah.
But that's why, because each of these ideas, each of the things I'm working on is in a different room.
They're in a different room.
And they're not really, you know, so. Yeah. Yeah, when I walk into that room, then I'm in the room of that idea, whatever that is.
And is that true for, does that hold true for the non-musical, if there are such things in your life, the non-musical things that you are wrestling with, thinking about, et cetera, that they somehow, they don't affect the art that you're working on, the music that you're making?
They do, but everything's got, like, what's the aesthetic? It's like designing a room. in your house. Like, there's an aesthetic of, like, I love the painting behind you, and I know you chose it because it's going to look great on camera. And, you know, there's an aesthetic about why the backdrop works, right?
Right.
The same is true of what's behind me. Yeah. There's an aesthetic of why that works, right? So in every creative room in your life, there's an aesthetic of what makes that thing work. And so, for example, let's take concert music, for example, a piece for, you know, people to perform live on stage. So think of all the things that would make that work. And a lot of them people wouldn't articulate if they're not in that, but things like there's an implied storyline in concert music. Like, even if you don't know what the story is, there's an implication that the audience is going on a journey.
Right.
That hopefully at the end of that journey, you'll feel like that journey was worth your time taking. And you feel like when you arrive at the end, you're like, oh, and here's where we are. And I didn't know we'd get here. But now that we are here, it makes total sense in light of everything that's come before.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be an aesthetic of a concert piece. Okay. That belongs in that room. And so you would know, you make choices in that room based on that idea, and that makes sense. And then in the case of a series, for example, you have ideas.
We're gonna get there.
Do you like that? Do you like that? There's a character arc, and you know, thematic themes, literary themes that reoccur as different characters, and you know, so you want the music to touch on those things. And so that's maybe that's a different type of aesthetic than a concert piece. Some similarities, some differences, but you, in order to decorate the room so that it looks good on Zoom, you have to follow the aesthetic of what the game is of that that creative expression. And I think that is applied to every creative expression that we could think of in the world.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever want the music from one room to inform what you're doing in another? Do you kind of, are there times when you invite it?
Well, yeah, because like if something's well designed, you know, just to take your backdrop, because I keep looking at it because I'm talking with you, you know, if I am a person who's if I like that aesthetic, then as an artist, at least what my brain does is it seizes on something it likes and goes, why does that work? You know, what is it about that makes that work? And you and what I do is I overanalyze every single thing about what I like about something. But there's a reason. And to some extent, when I'm analyzing, it drains the joy out of something. But I can use that to create, like, for example, if you know, there needs to be dimensions of something that feels aesthetically good matters. So what's in the background or what's in the foreground? And so that, something like that, applies to everything. So if I know something that works well, it's clear what's in focus and what's out of focus. There's no, that's not unclear at any point. Mm-hmm. That's something that can inform something else. And so if you're having that problem in another creative aspect, you can look at the one that's working and go, okay, why is that not a problem over here? And then when you notice the difference, I think that difference is something you absolutely apply to something else.
We can cut this out, but okay.
I'm sure all your podcasts are actually only 10 minutes. You just boil it down to the basics.
You always say things that, you know, take me to some other place that is like, ooh, well, what? Do you know other artists who are who do so in a way that is so, for lack of a better term, analytic, or are most of the artists that you know, work with, collaborate with, whatever, sort of they see things in holes, but do not attend to the particulars in the same sorts of ways you do? I don't know if that's clear,
but
that never stopped you.
I don't know the answer. I think because Of course, I'll analyze why I think I don't know the answer. It's because you tend to collaborate. I do best with people who look at things differently than me.
Yeah.
And therefore, I don't find other artists as analytical as me, but then that's what I bring to the collaboration.
Right.
You know, I probably collaborate best with artists who aren't bringing that, because that allows me to bring that aspect. But there are, for sure, and other composers from media especially, we are all very, most of the ones I know, I would, even though I haven't maybe gone this far into the weeds with them,
yeah,
their processes, you're required to be able to be okay with that because of just how, what you need to do to be able to be successful. Mm. But, mm-hmm, you know, but it also in talking about it, it's easier to talk about, well, I think because of my teaching background, I don't think that anything that I feel an obligation to be able to explain how I do everything. I think teachers like, you know, why does it work? It becomes, you can't teach if you can't explain in several different ways why something works.
Yeah.
So that's like, I've spent a lifetime analyzing why things work, and therefore it's just a natural part of, if something works, I need to be able to explain it to somebody else. So
do you miss that piece of your life? Well, maybe you're still doing teaching. Maybe I don't know that, but do you ever find yourself missing that? Forgetting me as a student.
No.
Your least successful piano student of all time.
Oh, one of my most successful managers, however.
But do you miss that aspect of your former life before you were Michael Abels?
I have the privilege of being able to be a guest artist in classrooms now.
Oh, no kidding.
And I speak to composers at different, you know, universities and things. And yeah. I am happy to be that I get asked to do that. And I try to say yes whenever I can.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like that's part of what I'm meant to do in the world, for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But also I get,
you don't have to grade papers.
If you're the guest artist, you get the best part of teaching.
You bet.
It's a completely spoiled in part without any of the parts that stress people out about teaching or make it.
Absolutely.
So I'm really lucky to be able to, you know, pick those.
Yeah, that's great. That's good, because that would be a shame if that was no longer, I mean, from my point of view, as a teacher, as a fellow teacher, and, you know, somebody who's worked in education, that would be a loss if you were not doing some of that. So good, I'm glad you are. So, funny you should mention series. Okay, so I know, and maybe everybody in the world knows, but certainly many people know, that you have been working, you were chosen to and have been working on the Star Wars series due to drop. Do they call it drop when it's a TV, when it's a streaming thing? Due to being on display to run next week, I believe. And
yes.
The Acolyte, right?
Correct.
So there's so many, I think, so many questions about is it the only series you've ever worked on, or
I did a docu-series called Alan versus Pharaoh.
I don't know that.
Yes, on was for Max, HBO Max. It was out about 2 years ago, I think. But that's a docu-series, and it's, you know, talk about a different room and a different genre and different,
yeah,
you know, quite different. Then this is my first scripted dramatic series that I've done. So, yeah.
And Is it one of those that will be, you know, all of the episodes will be out there at once and people can, you know, binge watch, or do they going to have to wait on the edge of their chair for the next week or whenever that plays?
The first two episodes are dropping on June 4th and then one a week after that. There's eight episodes, so you cannot binge the whole thing on June 4th, but right. By the end of July,
if you want to binge, you can wait till July.
Yes, it's very bingeable, in my opinion. Some series are like that, and I think it's one of those.
And is there talk of it continuing, or this was a thing, and it has a beginning and an end, and there will be no others, or is it a thing that could continue on?
Is there anything in Hollywood that could not continue
on? Yeah, really. After John Wick was killed in the last movie, like, and now there's another one. Wait, what?
You know, death of all the major characters does not preclude something.
Right. So
that's exactly. Not even a question, David.
That's like an informational piece. It's a loaded, one might say, overdetermined room you walked into, right? Star Wars right. has been around since our hair was darker.
Mm-hmm. and more plentiful in my case.
And yes, but me as well. I've always loved it. I've always loved Star Wars. You know, I could have preferences of one film over another and all that stuff and all the characters and yada, yada, yada. But there, one has to just scratch the surface barely and you find out there's so much audience judgment about the territory,
right?
That all and the characters and the costumes and the should this have come first? And I mean, it's kind of insane. And you now, I don't know if that's true for the musical environment. You know, if somebody will have specific criticism, oh my God, it was so fabulous, but the music, that's conceivable. But it's walking into a really opinionated, talk about a universe far, far away. It's like, wow. So did that carry a sort of like, what the hell? Right? Like, is this a good thing to do?
Oh, I didn't think of any of that at all.
Well, yeah.
I'm sure everybody will just welcome whatever I do for that judgment.
No one will say.
No.
Well, no one will say, wait, wasn't that other guy's name John Williams? Well, what was
John
his
what?
Name?
John Watson? I'm not really sure.
As good as...
yeah, it's pretty... You've just excellently summarized why someone might feel a little intimidated to do this. And why they might choose why they'd be intimidated to do it. And you can
were you intimidated?
Well, of course. Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you also, there's a point at which you can't allow yourself to like there's nothing creatively productive that's gonna come out of buying into that all of that by giving that power. You know,
right.
So,
and so, probably in some ways, kind of inviting more of it's like, you know, lobbing a softball off the plate. If it was too reminiscent of whatever that John guy's name was, right? If it was too reminiscent of that, that would be the criticism, right? I mean, so it doesn't, you can't escape it.
Well, how you look at it is from the point of view of, what is it that we're trying to create?
Yeah.
And that's true. Regardless of legacy or all those things, it, what is it we are trying to create? And the showrunner, Leslie Headland, who her she's a playwright, and her the show of hers that I was familiar with was a show called Russian Doll, which was the most bingeable, interesting series that I just stumbled into. And it's funny, and it's unpredictable, and you can't figure out what's going on, and the characters are charming but unique. And so I recommend Russian Doll just to anybody who'd like to stumble into Leslie's.
I just wrote it down. So
oh, great. Yeah, yeah. It's so intriguing. Anyway, so she reached out to me, and asked, I think she's a huge Star Wars fan. And she, I'm not sure, I think she pitched Lucasfilm is that she wanted to do a Star Wars series, and they, you know, are wanting to, you know, continue telling Star Wars stories is what they do. So Leslie then reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to do the music, she's amazing and great. And I've been a Star Wars fan my entire life. Mm. And I'm certainly a fan of John Williams. I mean, he's.
Oh, that's that guy. That guy's.
Yeah, name. Yeah. I knew the name would come to me if I
yeah, just eventually
went back to the room where I remembered what it was. And we've all of us composers have learned just by listening to the way his music connects with the soul. Mm. So, as intimidating as it might be to do, a Star Wars series, it's also the chance of a lifetime for any composer. And I was really eager to do it, as much as I was also intimidated by the idea.
Did you know her? Did she know you before? She knew.
I had not known her previously. But we. So what? In this story, it's all new characters. It's not based on any existing Star Wars novels or.
You could do the quick synopsis. Mm-hmm. Don't tell anyone content, but it takes place, as I understand it, it takes place before any of the first Star Wars takes place.
Before all those, yeah. You know, Luke Skywalker or the people you made.
Right. They weren't even born yet, right?
Weren't even born. Centuries before. And it's a time of peace in the galaxy, and the Jedi are actually at their height in terms of how they're respected and functioning within the universe. And these are all new characters, and but it's the Star Wars world. You have the, the Jedi, as I've mentioned, and you have the Force, and you have lightsaber battles and amazing intergalactic or intergalactic travel. But then there's evil lurking, isn't there always tends to be something evil lurking, but there are a lot of characters that you wouldn't have seen in a Star Wars universe before. And they have there's some moral conflict. There's things that, when presented, seem like they are a good thing. And then later on, we see something from another character's perspective. We see that, that may not have been a good thing. Or in this thing that we perceive as being a threat, maybe that's what we ought to be rooting for. Mm. And this is a real, this was something, telling the story in that way was something that really excited Leslie. And having a series where you have, you know, hours to fill rather than, you know, an hour and a half or two, you have a chance to revisit a story and tell it from a different perspective. And that was a really exciting feature of doing it this way.
And when you're creating the music for it, so you get to read, you get to read the story before and in advance. So you might know that this thing that you're rooting for may also have the darker underbelly. And do you, Michael Abels, the artist, do you put that hint musically in the, how do you
yeah,
think about
well, so this is, so it's the storytelling aspect, and this is what you spend most of your time talking with a filmmaker, with a showrunner about is like, how do you, you know, is this a moment of foreshadowing where we want to, in spite of what you see on the screen, foreshadowing musically would be using music that allows people to know that all is not as it appears.
Right.
Or are you telling the story in this moment purely from the character's experience, which is just they have this information and everything seems fine because mm-hmm. that's what you include. And how much do you want to peek behind the curtain at any given moment? And music is really important at giving us a peek when it's important for totally. A story. And you can't always tell on screen. This is why talking to everyone is important, because that will play very differently when the music changes.
Yeah.
And that's all a conscious choice that's made. So I'll ask and I'll do a pass at something, but then maybe it gives away too much, or it doesn't give away enough or something. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, it's surprising how much it's so interesting to have a conversation with I worked with the showrunner Leslie and two of the key producers, and we would sometimes talk about a character and talk about what that character is thinking. And even though Leslie wrote the show and the producers know every single scene, each of us would have a different take on what the character was thinking in that moment. And it's fascinating for that reason to see how, even though people who know the story can have a different impression of what someone in that position might be thinking. Mm-hmm. And all of those opinions went into how we would approach the music and what mm-hmm. was the choice. And fortunately, Leslie's the type who, as much as she knows her characters and the story and what she, so she's clear on that. But hearing this feedback from other people really helps inform her about how to tell the story. Mm. So all of that is like, it's like these discussions that we have. And then I go back and try to learn from that in the music that I write.
So for maybe everybody in the universe other than me knows this, but you just said, so she's a showrunner, and she is, what is that role in the, that's different from the director of a movie, I'm assuming.
Sort of. Well, this is what I'm learning as I do these projects. And also, no one ever, a great thing about the entertainment industry, or at least it's been my experience, is that no one ever tells you this. You figure it out while you're doing your job. And you pretend you know these answers. And then also people speak in acronyms, and then you are just left to...
Right. There's no site you can go look that up.
Right. No, well, there are now.
There probably are.
I have often had to, you know, like people just refer to ADR, like you know what that is, and you're just expected to know. And then EPK, you have to know what that is too. And so... you can Google those things and then you can act informed, because that's what I had to do at some point along these steps. Anyway, so in film, the director is the chief creative officer. And, among a bunch of other stakeholders who are often producers, could be the writer, sometimes, you know, and sometimes lead actors are also producers. And so, right. But all the people, regardless of what title you'd assign them, are stakeholders. And usually, ideally, the creative head is the director who makes the decision. In series, the creative head is the showrunner, which is a funny word, right. Because it's made up of basically exactly what you do.
Kind of what it is. So, right.
You're the showrunner. But the showrunner, it usually, I say usually, like I know, I don't really know. But they are, I think their first step that a showrunner has to do is create the story arc over a series of episodes. There needs to be a story arc of what's gonna happen, you know, not in the detail. Well, where a movie, there's all, someone writes an arc, I'm sure, but often you start with a script because someone has written, you know, a script right. of 120 pages or whatever. Right. With a series, usually there's so much script that they start with an overlying story arc. And from there, so a showrunner is probably a writer first and then a director.
And is the showrunner frequently the writer of the show?
Yes, in the sense that the showrunner created the concept. of the show. Oh, and wow. Created also the story arc. So that's very much a writing function. They have written, they've written the story.
Yeah.
The details, but then there's the, but then out of that comes a lot of work in two ways. There's a lot of writing of the actual scripts.
Right.
There's a lot of directing of the actual episodes. So in a series, those functions are then delegated by the showrunner to a room full of writers who write all the scripts, and then more than one director, because episodes
could be,
because then they parse it out in the way you'd shoot, like, you know, there's certain episodes that involve certain sets. And so they have a director handle those sets because they happen to be, especially if they're on location,
right,
they're going to send one director on that location to do all the episodes that involve that.
Right.
So a show will have probably more than one director.
Mm-hmm.
And that might include the showrunner, who is probably also director and also wants to direct.
Mm.
But it's not, I don't know if that's expected.
Yeah.
So now
yeah.
you have to talk to a producer who hires these people.
Yeah.
This is what I've noticed from watching.
Yeah.
So the showrunner is a writer who makes the creative decisions because she's the showrunner, you know, and Leslie also directed, I think, two, and she directed at least two of the episodes of the eight. And then there were at least two other directors as well.
Composing for this is substantially different from composing for a film, or because it's a series, is it a lot more interactive, or is it at its core that, you know, the same thing? You're telling the emotional aspect of this story in a way that can't be done with just emotions of actors on the screen, unless they're amazing, right?
But at its core, it's the same thing. But yeah. in there's a couple of practices that are different. One is that it's you when things start to work. You know, when you first begin a project of like this, it's a heavy lift because everything is new and you're right. figuring out what's going to work.
Right.
Then some things start to work, and when they do, then you're always looking for how can what is working be repurposed later, not only because, you know, recurring themes are important in storytelling, but also they help you get your work done. So they do two things. So when something works, it ends up informing something else even more than it would in a story that's only 2 hours. You know, like there are things in you know, episode eight is very much influenced by episode one and all the things that came before. And so thank goodness that it is, because when you get to the giant climax of things, you know, it's nice to have to know what you're doing when you get there in a way that you've been setting up for, you know, over a period of months rather than.
Right.
So that's the way that is different. But then also, most of it has to do with that.
And how long did the whole project take, like your aspect, your piece of it? Is that how long did it take to bring this to, well, not to bring it to fruition, but your part of it?
Yeah, the reason the time is hard to give a succinct answer for is because there's some on-camera music, which is, you know, there's singing on camera, and there's a ceremony, and it's in episode three. And but because it's on camera, think about it, that music has to be done first, because they've got to there has to be music for them to shoot to. So therefore, I had to start with that and record that. And then the coolest part about that was that I got to go on set while they record, because I explained to them that they had to have me there as a consultant, you know, that was only made sense, and someone believed this. And so I got to be there on set of a Star Wars series.
Fabulous.
Yeah. It was a real, real, really joyful as a fan. But then nothing, they were shooting for months after that. So then I didn't really work on it, did other things. And then when they were done, they came back and started working on the music. And so the post-production part of it, probably 6 solid months. And I was doing maybe one other thing, but then like the end of it, the last 3 or 4 3 months probably was just all the Acolyte all the time.
Wow. This is a big project. This is a big project. And the other thing that was that floating around, and because I don't know the pieces of that. Did what you do for the Acolytes require sort of dipping into different, for lack of a better way of saying it, sort of sonic territory, like sounds that did not necessarily occur from piano, et cetera, and yet you had to have them embedded in your composition?
There's different, we talked about what things were really important for the design of what people know as Star Wars. How do we design? There's a creative design that gives people what they love about Star Wars. And so it was important that this series fulfill that, for it to relate to everything else. In spite of the fact this is new characters, it's still the Star Wars universe.
Right.
And we needed to make sure that we delivered on that in a way that felt authentic to both, authentic to the fans first, but that's the job of us as producers and creatives to do that. But then also it's new, and it's a new story and new characters, and they have moral dilemmas and things, and we want music that helps tell that. So the music's a balance of the traditional. It's very large and lushly orchestral in a lot of places. But then also there are some fight scenes that are very inspired by martial arts. And that's a deliberate part of the storytelling. And it's one of the first things you see in the series. And so Leslie really wanted that music to be very percussive and not feeling orchestral. And yet it couldn't feel like electronic. It had to feel like organic, natural percussion. So we used a bunch of drummers, taiko drummers, and percussion of many different cultures to give it this non-specific other sort of sound to it that's really that's just meant to feel like visceral attack energy. And so that was one sonic world, and then there is the sonic world of the emotional big music, Star Wars, and that's part of it. And then there's a very troubling kind of chaos element that's done with, I use a lot of aleatoric effects, which it means people playing music randomly, which is something I've done before, because we do that a lot in tense and not in horrific environments, not horror, but things that are pretty terrifying. Then there's some sound design, virtual digital instruments as well, blended in with that to give it a quality that feels natural, but also you can't identify what's making that sound. That's very.
And that's so perfect. Did this require you, now it's clear. We're moving into territory that is way out of my depth, but were you composing it outside of the 12-tone scale? And how did you know in certain situations, I need a sound that comes from that instrument that I don't play,
I mostly write music for other people to play. Like, I'm not as good. I could not sit in the gig with the instrumentalists I'm privileged to be able to hire.
Right.
They're much more skilled at their instruments than me. So I'm constantly, I think of myself musically like a playwright. Like, a playwright can't be both the Wizens, mentor, and the young ingenue, but you have to know what that character would say from their soul. And so I'm trying to always write music that feels really idiomatic for each instrument. And when I hear a melody, I think of, what would sound good performing this melody, and that comes from what emotion is the melody meant to evoke in the listener. And that's how I choose. Mm-hmm. Palette, whether that's an instrument that we know or whether it's one, it's a sound that doesn't really exist, but it gives you this feeling. And if it feels right, it is right when it comes to doing music for storytelling.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting territory. I have a couple of things I want to make sure I ask you about. And one has to do with the Composer Diversity Collective. Yeah. And the other is more about you. And, you know, when we started, I made mention of why I so look forward to conversations with you, and that, you know, you swim in, you make your way in environments that are not entirely always just about music. There, you know, you are capable of going to all sorts of different, my experience of you, you are capable of going to all sorts of different places that are interesting, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm curious, what would you say is your current learning edge? You know, that place where it's not necessarily comfortable. It's not uncomfortable. It's not unpleasant, but it is. It requires learning. It requires moving into territory that you're not familiar with, and that doing a TV series like this obviously was something, right? But I'm curious if there's a territory that you are, you know, you're spending time thinking about, whether it's about your artistry or not, that that is uncomfortable, and it's the wrong word, because it's not meant to suggest an unpleasant territory. It's like when I think that's one of the things that I was most fascinated by when I first sat in on that, your middle school beginning piano class, right? That time, what I noticed about it was, unlike any other time in my life, I was a beginner. That's not unlike any other time in my life, but being a beginner was not unpleasant. In fact, it was, I loved it. I loved the, I can't make my hand do that. And then watching myself moving in the direction of, geez, I can suddenly make my hand do that. And it actually changed being a beginner at something for me, I hope forever, because it was such a pleasant experience. Whereas, you know, in my past, being a beginner was like, you know, it was awful. It was just awful. I can't do this. It was frustrating. It was rah, 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 all that kvetching that, you know, we all did when we were whatever. And So is there a learn, and that's what I would refer to as, at the time, that was my learning edge. I was attending not to the piano piece, but to the, what does it feel like to begin in with this whole other emotional valence that I had never had before. So does Michael Abels have currently have a learning edge that he is aware of?
Well, I do, but just quick, so I'm so honored that you had such a wonderful experience of being people. What people listening and watching wouldn't know is that David was sharing a keyboard with a middle school student, a sixth grader, and they were side by side, like where you could both sit at a keyboard. So they were right next to each other. This was in a room full of 20 other middle schoolers, all playing an electronic keyboard at the same time, and not the same thing, mind you. So for you to have an experience of profound joy in a situation really challenged all of us to be able to find the joy in situation.
Yeah, it was fabulous. It really was
that
fabulous.
Was amazing. I think that some of that, your ability to find joy in a beginning situation like that, just speaks to you. I don't
think Thank you.
All of us are capable of maybe aspiring to that, but that would not have been my joyful spot. But nonetheless, I do have one. But I have been trying to learn to do a handstand.
No kidding.
Oh, yes. And I have been trying to do this. I've had this goal. I'm embarrassed to say how long I've had it. So, but I've had it since before the pandemic. And I have made very little progress in the amount of time. But my excuse is that there have been huge gaps in my attempt to learn this. And I'm extremely a person who, in terms of my whole physical body, I'm not very coordinated. Unlike my hand coordination, my whole physical body does not work together instinctively unless I train it one tiny step at a time, you know? And what I need is consistency. And every time I start to have some consistency, I do make a little progress and it fills me with joy. Maybe this is
similar to that's interesting. That's so interesting. And I don't know if you remember this about me. I probably did it at an opening meeting. You may have not been there because
yes,
because how you felt about opening meetings.
Yes, I was an opening meeting.
There was an after, you know, I couldn't do it right now because I had rotator cuff surgery. But I've been doing handstands since I was a gymnast in high school. But let me just give you one thing that helped me, and it may have nothing to do with your coordination, but it actually came from learning about how we balance on our feet. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, you know, we sort of think about we're standing there and we're just standing on our feet. But in fact, when that is analyzed in detail, what you find is that we're not just standing. It is not a static process at all. The feet themselves are moving and changing where the pressure is all the time. And one time I got up on my hands, and that wasn't hard to do, but I started to pay attention to, I just started by moving my hands, putting pressure in different ways. I think I might've been against the wall and realized I had a lot. I could with relatively little effort, make a lot of progress finding balance by literally just trying to, you know, sort of randomly put pressure on my fingers and put pressure on my thumb and put pressure. So you might try that next time you're upside down and see if that gives you a clue to something that lies ahead.
I love that. And so, absolutely. Thank you. This is why we talk.
This is why we do this. And what a perfect place to end. But wait, you didn't say anything about the Composers Diversity Collective.
The Composers Diversity Collective. I am no longer the president. The presidents are Emeritha Vaz and Sandra Morales, and it's very much thriving, and it's a community where people from every walk of life who are interested in being media composers can join and find commonality and incredible difference. And we are just helping people redefine what a composer looks like in their minds and what type of music you might expect a person who looks a certain way to write. Mm. And just by existing, we help people identify what those preconceived notions are and whether those serve us or don't. And also a resource for producers and directors who are looking to be more inclusive in their hiring, mm-hmm. and need a little help with that. And it's also a place for composers to come and find commonality. And so if someone is interested in being a composer or finding a composer, please check out the Composers Diversity Collective, because we have what you're looking for.
And I'll put up the URL for that, so people, if they've heard that, can find it. So, well, Michael Abels, always a treat, and I so love our conversations. So thanks for being willing once again, and now. Thank
you. Always my pleasure. Always my pleasure to speak with you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.